This is the Fly Culture Podcast with me, your host, Pete Tigis. Jim Williams has been in and around fly fishing for more years than I can remember. Known primarily as a fly fishing guide, furled leader expert, and more recently as brand manager for Vision Fly Fishing in the UK. He is a master fly casting instructor who has a passion for his home water, the Colne, that is just a short distance from where he lives in Wiltshire. He also travels to Canada to fish the remote streams for cutthroat trout. I sat down with him to talk fishing, leaders, and fly casting. So welcome everyone to the very latest Fly Culture podcast. I'm having a sit down with my good friend Jim Williams to talk about fishing and life in general. I've driven up from Devon this morning to meet him in Wiltshire. Jim, thanks for having me.
Welcome, Pete. This is welcome to Little Summerford.
And it's looking good. The sun's shining. Everything seems to be pretty good right now. So what we thought we'd do is start at the very beginning, Jim. And Little Summerford, is that your home? Is that where you've come from or...?
Little Summerford is where I live. Where I originate from is a place called Winsford in Cheshire. Probably not far north enough for me to be called a northerner. Certain people I know wouldn't call me a northerner, but yeah, that's where I originate from Cheshire.
And you came down here how many years ago?
Oh.
Was it work or Sarah? Or
yeah,
it,
we... Yeah. Leaving school, literally the week I left school, however long ago that was, so far back I can't remember, was the week we moved down here, originally into Swindon, and obviously having lived a bit of a life and moved into numerous locations, I'm sort of just on the outskirts of Swindon, all bar about 17 miles.
And so fishing, has that always played a big part in your life?
Yeah, I think for me... And my friends at the age I was when I was back at school, you know, and you'll hear it probably more times than not, not having the sort of likes of the computers and all the type of technology that we have nowadays. It was invariably that was the type of the dumb thing when I was a lad. So it was course fishing was the passion to start off with, to be truthful, because I was nowhere near, or I didn't have access to or couldn't get to at the time. Probably fly fishing destinations, and to be honest, fly fishing wasn't even on my radar then when I was a young lad. So it was sort of roach fishing, rod, all that type of stuff. So that was my introduction into fishing originally.
And then how did fly fishing come into your life? Was it by chance or was it natural progression from
no,
course fishing?
It was more by chance of a holiday actually. My father, who'd fly fished for many, many, many years, and his friend used to travel to Ireland and Scotland. And I just got the opportunity whereby a holiday coincided, or my time away from school, coincided with a trip that they were taking to Scotland. And so I was invited to go up there, purely to spend a father and son type week away. And we were in Scotland, and it was actually to a place called Kinbrace, which is in Sutherland, which I've frequented many, many, many times since with my father. And that was my introduction to fly fishing. And from that moment on, I have to tell you, all the course fishing gear just went in the garage forevermore. Thanks. For wherever I decided to then put it. That fly fishing experience that week, for that particular week, was the be-all and end-all of my course fishing.
And did that make it hard going so far to go fish and then coming back to where you were living? And then finding fishing, or was that the next thing? You sort of looked for places you could go fish locally and
it grew
from there?
Well, it was more to do with the fact that my father, having I suppose, been bitten by the bug. What do you have it? The phone goes. Having been bitten by the bug, he'd then take me fishing. More opportunities came my way. And so rather than go course fishing by myself and with some of the friends that I used to go course fishing with, it was just a slight steering to continue the interest of fly fishing that I had. And at that time, it was always with my father until he started meeting people and you started having friends that were otherwise interested in fly fishing, and so it just diversified then. But I just got more opportunities to go on the
fly. And did you follow the, I guess, when we were doing it and started doing it, the traditional route of starting off on small still waters, possibly reservoirs, and then discovering rivers? Was that the path that you took?
Small still waters, never reservoirs, to start off with. I suppose it was small still waters, and then funnily enough, the one that always came to the forefront of my mind was actually Farmore.
Mm.
That's where I probably, at the time, got into fly fishing in a big way, because it was, once we'd moved to Swindon, it was convenient. It's literally, dare I say, 45 minutes up the road. And at every opportunity, myself and my father got to go to Farmore, because it's a fabulous, fabulous fishery with some amazing quality fish, albeit it's a concrete bowl, so not the prettiest of places, but everything was navigable. You could get round the whole reservoir. It was big enough to be daunting and know that you're in a big sort of landscape of water, but not big enough that you didn't feel like you couldn't fish it. And that's where I made all my mistakes. That's where I learnt all the tricks of the trade. I say tricks of the trade that I was taught by Dad. That's the only sort of learning curve from there, other than reading reference books. Rivers came a lot later, almost to a degree where I knew my foundation was set, first of all. So I had to be good enough to go on a river. And I don't mean that in a disparaging way. Mm. I mean, I wanted to be good enough before I decided to go onto a river, if that makes sense.
Absolutely. It's interesting, coming back to Farmore, although I've never fished it, it seems to be, amongst stillwater anglers, one of those places that people go, wow, Farmore. And is there any reason for that, do you think?
From whatever social media I've seen, from whatever literature I've read in magazines, you know, and your last podcast guest, I know Nick Harter's fished it on numerous occasions and caught some huge, huge fish, as I know many others have. The quality apparently is just phenomenal. I've not fished it for a good while, don't get me wrong, because you know, when the opportunity of a river arises to go and fish, I'd rather fish that than any other location, to be truthful. So I've not fished Farmore for a good while, but I always remember that it was always open. You were never restricted, other than depending on how low on the wall you stood, because it was this concrete bowl. You could cast as far as you could cast within your capabilities, and there was, you know, because it had boats, and it was a case you could cast as far as you wanted, you could fish as deep as you wanted, and you could try as many techniques as you wanted. Sunk line, intermediates, floating. There was almost like no restriction. And I mean that in a sensible way, because it was sensibly run. Mm. You know, you were well catered for, well looked after, and it just happened to be that the quality of the fish there just seemed to that seemed to be housed in that particular water were just fantastic in every way. Whether that be fighting, rising when they could to hatches, whatever they may be, and eating. I mean, not that I've eaten fish now for, I want to say, not that I've eaten, not, I don't, I mean, it's a long time since I've ever killed a fish. Long, long time, you're talking sort of 12 years plus.
Mm.
But I remember that they were exceptional eating fish. Mm. And I think still now, the quality of them, from what I've seen and images I've seen, they, you know, tells like absolute rudders. They're still as good now as they ever were. And I remember that significantly at Farmore.
Wow.
Yeah. Great fishery.
I just never hear bad words about
the
place.
And I can't say I ever have.
Yeah.
I can't say I ever have.
Yeah. So your fishing is going up several gears now. Are you starting to think about this as a career? Was there a path? Was there somebody that you sought advice from that helped you with qualifications, bits and pieces like that? Was it starting coming into your psyche that you're thinking, actually, this kind of might be a direction I want to go in?
Well, it really stemmed from my dad taught me to cast rubbishly. And we joke about it now when we fish, because I pick him up on it. And it was always your back cast. Your rod's going too far back on the back cast. And I remember those words singing, and it was always the same. And it was, and I've got a bit of an inbred issue, logic and all that type of stuff, OCD.
Mm.
Where if I'm doing something, it's got to be done properly and well.
We're going to come on to that with leaders, yeah.
And I just have this way, which if I'm going to do something, I want to do it well. And so, my father was happy with his lot. And don't get me wrong, my dad's the best fisherman I've ever seen, and he always will be.
Mm.
And he's the best caster I've ever seen, no matter how bad he is, and he always will be.
Yeah, yeah.
It's just one of those things. It's your dad. But I wanted to do it better, more, further, farther, faster, stronger, all that type all that type of stuff. And so I started looking at this was not in terms of wanting it as a job or to do something part time. I just needed to know how to do this better. In the same way that you'd want to learn to drive properly, know how to ride a bike properly and all that type of stuff. I just wanted to do this better. And so I sourced what was available by way of who and how and where. Remember, we only had the magazines then.
Yes.
And word of mouth.
Yeah.
Now, fortunately, my father's friend was a reasonable caster. So I spent a bit of time with him. But to be honest, most of it was self-taught.
Mm.
And that may sound strange, but I've got a head for working it out. Don't get me wrong, it's, you know, what some people may have learned in an hour, it may have taken me 10.
Mm.
But I've got a head for working it out, and the logic process of how it follows. My succeeding came out of all the failures.
Mm.
You know, if you're going to succeed, you have to fail first.
Yes.
And so, you know, I got good at casting in my own mind. I mean, many people would say otherwise. In my own mind, to a point where it was pretty competent, in my own view.
Mm.
Not that anybody had assessed me in any way, shape or form.
Mm.
And so without any formal training, the fisheries just dropped off the tip of my tongue. Went to a fishery for STANIC, the Salmon and Trout Association National Instructor Certificate. And I remember being assessed, actually. It was the very last time STANIC was being assessed for any weekend before it became something else.
Mm.
I can't remember how long ago that was. But I remember being assessed by Gary Champion at the time, Ron Holloway, good old Ron.
Yeah, yeah.
And Vic Knight.
Wow.
And that was my...
That's a tough crowd as well.
It was a tough ask. Well, especially Ron Holloway, right? Because he was a traditionalist.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and his way of casting back
over
then
the
was...
Yeah,
yeah, yeah. Over the tip and chopping cucumbers, all that type of stuff. Yep. Buck under the under the elbow. You know, and that is that with, you know, Gary Champion and Vic Knight. And look, and I got it. I got that certificate. For whatever it's worth... And for what everybody, you know, wants to say, whatever it was at the time, it was what it was.
Mm.
It was as good as it got.
Yep.
Before you moved on to, I think, APGAI at the time, and I wasn't even aware of that at the time. So I got that. I'm pretty pleased as bloody punch, to be truthful.
Mm.
And then I got approached by Roddy Ray.
Yep.
Are you remote?
Yes. Yeah. Devon man. Yeah. Yeah.
Roddy Ray, and he was, forgive me if it was the secretary or treasurer of REFIS. You know, the register of fly fishing instructors to schools, and I had a bit of an assessment from Roddy, and it was to do more with guiding and fishing, and you know, I'm not saying I'd gone from STANIC straight to REFIS the week later. There'd been a number of years between the two, so I'd built up quite a good foundation. Not teaching at the time necessarily. I'd done a wee bit for friends. But I'd had a good foundation. I'd moved on to rivers quite quickly then, and I was really into my fishing. I just lived for fishing, full stop. It's all I ever did. And then I'd spent a bit of time with Roddy, and I was then enrolled in the sort of REFIS. So I had this sort of STANIC and REFIS. At the point where, you know, when did it turn into a hobby? From a hobby, I suppose, into a job. Crikey. We're going back to pre-1997. Must have been, yeah, I was guiding then, guiding and teaching. So, yeah, we're almost sort of, we're almost back 30 years now. And I'd, so my early 20s, I'd started to be more focused on teaching and guiding the places that I knew. My sort of work background, I've always been in retail, majority of the time, you know, for what I remember, all the meaningful jobs that actually helped me earn a crust and get a car and all that type of stuff was retail. So customer focused. So this job is customer focused. This guiding and teaching is very much customer focused. And so it was almost, it almost felt like it was the same job, but just with different tools, with a different end product. And so I ended up getting a job part-time and started to lean more towards teaching and guiding. And at that time, there wasn't many people doing it.
Similar conversations I have.
To that conversation with interest with Nick, there's a lot of similarities, an awful lot of similarities. I mean, I didn't know Nick at the time, but Nick, I remember Nick because of his articles. He was always in. You know, he was quite prominent in writing articles and his skills and sharing the information that he did in all the magazines. So that's where I knew Nick from. And it's funny how I got to meet Simon Gawsworth, which will come on a wee bit later, because he was quite significant.
It's a common thread, isn't it?
It is.
He's well, a it's wonderful a small, legacy, isn't
it's
it?
It's a small world, right?
Yeah.
This fishing lark is a small world.
Yeah.
And if you're in the industry, you get to know all the same people that you looked up to a degree.
Yeah.
Because they're in the industry too, still.
Yeah.
And so the... I just lost my train of thread there, Pete. When I got into... This sort of customer service, it seemed like the right thing to do. I can't give you a definition of why it was right to move from to go left instead of right or go right instead of left, but it just meant that I'm quite technical, you know, websites and that type of stuff, and I made my own website. I'm one of these that will just try stuff and get it wrong and then get it right, you know, this sort of failure to succeed. And so I built a website, pretty basic, but people started getting in touch because more to do with my location rather than I was the only one in the area that did it or there wasn't enough. But people could only go to that magazine. You know, they were in the heydays of the Trout Fisherman, the Trout and Salmon. And I advertised in those particular magazines and people started to get in touch and word of mouth spread. You know, you try and do a good job, you try and do your best job, word of mouth spread and you get more work and suddenly it's that influx of interest from people wanting to either go fishing with you for you to teach them or just to have an experience. The more that started to increase in number, the more the decision was came to the fore that I could do this, and I could do this full time, perhaps.
I think it's really interesting rewinding a tiny bit where you say about service industry, and I know, and I'm sure you used to get many more calls, but I know I get calls from people about I'm really good at catching fish, I want to be a fishing guide, but I think a lot of the time people don't realise you are actually in the service industry, and you're not going fishing every day as well.
Yeah.
And looking after people and understanding their needs is probably the biggest part of it, I think, isn't it?
Yeah. And I remember, you know, again, I'll probably refer back to that first podcast because it's a good one to refer to because it's the only one that you've done thus far with Nick, which is, you know, and I would extol this to any person out there that is a guide. Never fish when you're teaching or guiding. I suppose the two go hand in hand. I mean, when you teach in purely casting, you're not necessarily fishing anyway. But it was, I would, most of my fishing, you know, probably come on a bit later, you know, which is probably my favourite fish. Most of my fishing was done after the event, after having spent most of however long that was with a particular customer. I would never go down river whilst a client was under my tenure or care to try and learn what I'm trying to teach them to go and catch a fish. Mm. It was just not the dumb thing. Mm. And I won't accept that from anybody. Mm. You know, I won't accept that argument, however well they may put it to me, that is acceptable.
Yeah.
It, to me, it just isn't and never was ever. And so, because that to me is a customer service. Customer service is not greeting somebody then walking away.
Yeah.
And that's what that almost. What that almost does, and you know, and I'd be very stringent with that. Yeah. Just to me, it's just unacceptable.
And it's lovely to hear you so passionate about that as a guide. Although you've not, how long did you guide for? And is it 5 years you've not been guiding now? Or
I've not done it since 2013.
Right. Yeah.
And I say not done it. I've not done it as much. I've done it far less because I'm in a different part of this industry now. So I've done it far less. But like a bike, you never lose that. Fishing, how much has fishing changed since we ever started doing it back in the day of Yold? And the product has changed, but the wading is still the same. We're just wearing different stuff. You know, the fish are still the same, just in a different pocket of water. Probably no rivers look the same now as they did 100 years ago, just because of the way nature works. Mm. You know, so it's never really any different. It's how we approach it and what we approach it with.
I think one of the things I noticed, funnily enough, I did some tuition with somebody the other day, and he said, oh, I'm self-taught. And I'd have probably 10 years ago thought, probably even 5 years, possibly less, I don't know. But being self-taught, you think, oh dear, I'm going to have to try and get rid of these faults. But now with the likes of YouTube and everything else, I find when somebody says they're self-taught, I say, well, let's have a look. And it's actually a lot better than you think it's going to be. That's one of the things I've noticed in more recent times, that those sorts of things have helped anglers become better.
Yeah, I'd say that to a degree.
Yeah.
I've seen good and bad.
Yes.
And I'll tell you why. And I think it's sometimes in the nature of the individual that, you know, you can get two people to look at the same video and interpret it in two very different ways. One understands it, the other just doesn't get it.
Yeah.
And so the one that can understand it and translate that to what they do is that guy you're probably talking about. Mm. Is that guy that's got better.
Yes.
The other guy is still... is still none the wiser, and he's still very good at what he's really bad at.
There's nothing like sitting down with somebody and explaining and spending time with their casting, and
no,
so there's still room for fishing instructors.
Absolutely, yeah. but you have to hope. And Pete, I'm going to be really honest. I enjoy watching YouTube a lot for very different reasons.
Don't go too deep.
I'm not going to take you to look at my website. But there is just so much rubbish, and I mean utter rubbish, where people just think that they are qualified, for want of a better word, to teach you by video, death by video, on how to cast or fish correctly, for whatever reason, you know, for this umbrella of fly fishing. But for as much rubbish, there is as much good. There's some really, really good stuff from people that I otherwise admire and respect, and people that have put in the time and have earned the stripes. I've gone out there and done it. They're the ones that I would look for. It's trying to find the chiff from the chaff. And so as much rubbish as there is out there, sadly, some people are exposed to that, but don't know they're being exposed to that.
It was, you know, I remember when you were guiding full time, and the comments you've just made are straight up and honest, which I always like, and that's one of the reasons I used to speak to you a lot, Nick, and because you'd be honest about it, and I'd say, "God, it's a quiet week, this one. How are you getting on?" And you'd be saying exactly the same. And whereas saying, "Oh no, I can't stop," you know, it's you'd say, and I kind of really liked that honesty about it, and being able to talk to people in the industry that I knew and respect deeply that you could say, how's it going? You know, yeah. Are these sorts of things happening? Yeah. So I think that's why I enjoyed talking to you.
I'm not one for rolling it in glitter.
No, and that's why I like it, to be honest. You know, it's straight up and I appreciate that greatly. So the guiding took more of a back seat. Was it because longevity of it, or this opportunity with Vision came along, and was it a combination, or you just felt like a change? Or
no, the opportunity arose. Now you've what you'll see today, and I think it's very different from when I was teaching and guiding full time. Is today there's a lot more guides and instructors. And that's just that's just the
it's
way
tough
it is.
To set up now, isn't it?
It is. There because of the nature of, I suppose, whatever the medium that people are able to use now, there are a lot more. There may have been a lot more when I was doing it full time, but without the internet, you didn't know that. If they didn't advertise in the magazines you were advertising in, you assumed it was just a small collective of people. Mm. But it was obviously bigger than I was then. Mm. But now you can see it everywhere, and there's nothing wrong with that, but it almost feels like, to a degree, it's the same cake just sliced up a lot more.
Yes. Yeah,
sliced up a lot more. And I remember 2002 to 2005, I almost felt like I didn't have an hour's rest. It was just non-stop.
Yes. Yeah,
it was absolutely mental. I mean, I remember talking to you literally every other day, you know, just for some solace.
Yeah, yeah.
Just for some solace and sort of trying to get your head around some sort of normality, because like you, being on the water all the time, and it was phenomenal. Business was great. Mm. It was fantastic. One thing I started to notice latterly before 2013, so probably from about 2009-10 onwards, was that there were more gaps in my diary than there were full days, you know. And I'm quickly going to jump in there before people sussed you out.
Yeah.
there was just less people. Mm. There was less people. I found that the majority of people I was taking out were really good clients, were returning clients, and the whole emphasis seemed to change. More people, and the people that I was teaching were getting older. There was less of a desire for them to travel far and less of them as a desire to learn. They just wanted company on a day out.
Mm.
So the guiding was more than the tuition, because for the regular customers, I was almost like, I'm the guy that got the fly out of the tree.
Yeah.
I'm the guy that tied a new fly on. And we talked about general life and how good and bad things were, whatever they wanted to talk about. Mm. They just wanted some company.
Mm.
They weren't into going out by themselves fishing.
Mm.
They just weren't. And so it changed, and it got to a point where I think, being really, really honest, I'd have got a job elsewhere if I hadn't had the opportunity to come to or to go to guide fly fishing. I'd have purposely looked for a job, probably part-time, and still done a bit of part-time teaching and guiding. But the opportunity arose and I just grabbed it by the hand for a number of reasons, which was, it was just another great opportunity to do something else in this industry. Yeah. And I think it's, and the only way I can best explain it, your school years, you make the most of those opportunities whilst you're in school, and then that period of time comes to an end and you move on.
Mm.
That period of my guiding and teaching full time came to an end and I moved on.
Yeah.
And it's now where I am.
Yeah.
Which is for guide fly fishing.
Fantastic. And so before we geek out on leaders, which I know you're going to, I don't worry, we haven't got enough time. So you don't miss it, the guiding? Although you're doing tiny bits and pieces, not in the same way. It's a different...
I'll tell you what I do miss. I miss the teaching of fly casting.
Mm.
I miss the sharing of the knowledge that I've got. Because the guiding could be anything, right? Mm. The guiding could be, I mean, I've had as many good days guiding as I have bad days. And what I mean by that is blanking.
Mm.
You know, I'm not saying bad days because the guy's really had a disappointing day. And I know, don't tell me an angler's never disappointed for having blanked, because that's not the reason you go out there.
Yeah.
I was more disappointed for them. And Pete, you know the pressure.
Mm.
Come 4 o'clock before you get off the water at five and there's nothing caught. Yeah. and you're just willing. You're willing the guy. Even when there's fish, it's just not quite making the right type of cast or whatever, the presentation and the retrieve and all the stuff that is the glorious nature of fishing. Mm. And when he catches that fish,
it's a lovely thing,
honestly,
isn't it? Yeah.
It is just, it's a woohoo moment,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, I prefer the 9:30 in the morning.
Well, I do, because the pressure's off.
Yeah.
Because I just come out with those words, there you go, you've done it once, all you've got to do now is the most difficult part is repeating that.
I'm not counting, I'm not counting from then onwards.
And you let them get on with it.
Yeah.
So you have all those emotions, you know, as you say, but... you know, coming back to that question, which did I prefer, the teaching or the guiding? Both, but what I really enjoyed was sharing the knowledge that I have. And I've lots of it.
Fantastic.
I've lots of it.
Fantastic. Well, it's really interesting because the first time we actually spoke, I reckon it must have been early 2000s, and I bought some faux leaders from you to try them. And having spoken to you this morning about it, I can't believe... 1997, you were tying furled leaders, and probably in the UK, you were probably, if not the first, one of the first to look at these and really start manufacturing and selling them. And I remember the conversation with you because I was starting guiding and spoke to you a little bit about it. And the leader part of it, I know you're hugely passionate about. And I listened to something, I think it was Carl McNeil said, with fishing, you know, and we always look at rods first, really, but he was kind of saying you want to go backwards. And so flies, you know, we start at flies, but there's going to be regional variations, but the next thing is the leader. And I know that's where you get super excited, and talking about your wanting to know and understand, and knowing you as I do, that's how you sort of roll with these things, whatever you look at, with your running at the moment, your dog sledding, all the other things that you're hugely passionate about, that leaders were the same. Furled leaders, how did that come about then? So how did you discover those and realise or think there was potential for those to be have a place in the fishing market here in the UK?
I was just about to say, well, I remember, but I can't actually remember. What comes to the forefront of my mind is a reference in a book from Daryl Martin, Micropounds. And I knew of furled leaders prior to that, but I think that book was in 1999, I think, just pre 2000. And there was a reference to it in there that, for whatever reason, it might have been before that, but that reference just intrigued me because I was already tying my own leaders, and the reason being was, you know, what's in my head about how important leaders are is you buy the reel. It's a manufactured thing is a reel, as is the fly line, and as is the rod. But yet, what you present to a fish, being that of the fly, between that fly and the end of that fly line, is within your gift to profile in any way, shape or form you wish. That's not determined by anybody other than yourself. If you choose to use a manufactured leader, then they've taken that out of your hands, unless you do something with it and change it. If you use, let's just say, a level leader, oh my God, just that. And there's proper reasons for using a level leader, which I'll probably touch on in the next sort of 6 hours as this bit about leaders progresses. But what's in my mind is it is within my gift to touch the most important bit of the whole fishing setup that I physically have control over. Not necessarily tying flies at the time, because fly ties are just as important because obviously they tie a fly. But what that leader, having understood that leader is what connects me to a fish by way of a fly, obviously. The distance I can control from fly to fly line that negates that visibility to a fish of something I don't want them to see. I can control the translucency of it, because you can get different type of opaqueness and translucence of materials. I can control the profile of it from thick to thin in all the ways that you can think about the profile that's important to every angler in a fly line. You can extol that in a leader. And then there's the strength of something. Then there's the diameter. So when you look at all these nuances that go up to make a leader and what you can change within that, it is just immense. Absolutely immense. And so I was always, I'll say the word anal about leaders. Everybody knows what that means in terms of that. And then the detail was just everything to me because I had control of it. And so what it also did for me, because I wasn't tying flies at the time, was that it gave me something to do outside of fishing. So when I wasn't actually teaching or guiding, I could still be involved because all this stuff I did at home, right? Micrometers, all that type of stuff, the stiffness of one part of the leader to the suppleness of another. You know, I break a leader down into three, and I still do it now, which is, you know, a stiff part of the leader from the fly line, which is the transition into what I call the turnover phase, which is the middle bit, and then the presentation, which is the tip. And the stiffness and the diameters and all that is what goes up to make that to make that leader. Once I'd heard about furled leaders and how they progressed from days of yold in all the gut and the horse hair and how they created diameters, the Singapore leader, which you can do now with polymers and copolymers and so on, I just got really interested in to understand more. And I found the descriptors, I found just by searching, you know, once we'd got onto the internet, and I'd search magazines, and I wish I could remember the article that I'd seen that described it in such a way, the making of a leader, that I totally got and totally understood. And I still have now the same board pegs and all the stuff I used in 1997 here with me today.
Fantastic.
And so I could still break out that stuff because I've not made them for a good while. But the furled leader, what it did for me then was, you know, it allowed me to take these single materials and where I was making a profile of a leader by tying materials together, I could twist materials that would form part of a profile, but without all the visible knots. And the tapers I created, oh, I swear blind, the first one I could have towed a truck with it. It must have been about, you know, like an inch thick, like about 3 or 4 feet. It was just, it was incredible. You just wouldn't have snapped it if you'd have tried. You'd have to saw it in half to have broken it.
But how you roll, isn't it? You want to discover it.
That was it. Once you got to understand how you'd make a profile with this particular board, that I used in the pegs and the process, it just got me absolutely hooked again, even more so. And I got even more into the detail about how to make leaders. Because what I wanted to do then was, I knew how to make profiles. I knew what I needed to do with the lengths. What it was then about, well, what can I make it out of? And I always remember a particular leader I made out of this product called Maximus, through one of the retailers I used to deal with, and I actually made a furled leader that was stronger than any rod and fly line because it had a breaking strain of 119 pounds. Honestly, it was super super thin.
Yeah. Oh, really?
And it was like the everlasting gobstopper.
Yeah, yeah.
You'd only buy it once.
Yeah.
Because you couldn't break the darn thing.
Yeah.
Because this material was 0.006 in diameter. And it had a breaking strain per strand of 19 pounds.
Wow.
Once I twisted it into this profile of a tapered furled leader, the breaking strain was just immense.
And you said Maximus, not...
It was Maximus.
Just in case anyone's listening, what's the name?
Yeah, no, it was... I think it was made by Fladen. F-L-A-D-E-N.
Yeah, yeah.
Fladen or Fladen.
Yeah.
And it was just incredibly strong, super, super strong. And there used to be a haberdashery in my local village here. I used to go in there and purchase sewing threads, and in their singular nature, these sewing threads were super weak. Mm. I mean, there was just no strength in them at all. But when you start twisting them into a rope, which is like, any rope that you would see, by its individual strand, it is weak. But collectively, as you start to twist these strands, they can become immensely strong. Mm. And you can, and going back to this bit which I said about when I first started just making my own leaders, you know, I could control the stretch, the diameter, the colour. But there was one inordinate fault with third leaders. They wouldn't not turn over.
Right, yeah, yeah.
You couldn't. I found it really difficult to dump them.
Yeah, yeah.
Because they were just so efficient in transferring energy in the way that you construct a profile.
Even with a super long tippet?
What I'm talking about is the actual furl leader. What happens beyond that. Which is, I suppose, a probably a good part to mention here, is the way I looked about what a furl leader was, it was never the end result. You didn't tie a fly to it.
Mm.
What a furl leader for me became was the transition from a fly line to a leader. And so it didn't form part of my leader.
Mm.
What it actually was, it formed part of my fly line, or it formed part of neither. It was just a transitional point which I knew had fabulous turnover, great energy transition that would either pull all that energy out of the fly line in the most controlled and efficient manner.
So you're
in the same way as it pushed it into the leader that I wanted to.
Got you. So you're fishing a furled leader 4 or 5 feet, I guess?
Yeah, I mean, I suppose a really good common size for me was a 48-inch furled leader.
Yep.
And on top of that, I would still then build, I'd probably have a 9-foot leader, 15, whatever I could turn over. You know, one of my philosophies when somebody said, well, how long a leader should I use? You use one as long as you can physically turn over. The longer you can have a leader that
distance,
puts you away from the fish, the better.
Yeah.
But there's no point in having a 15-foot leader on if the last 5 feet is falling in a hoop of spaghetti.
Yeah.
So the length of the leader was never, it was never make a 48-inch furled leader so I can attach a 9-foot main leader in however I then continued that profile. It was always, the furled leader was purely about the transition of energy from the fly line to the leader. Depending on where I was fishing and how I was fishing is what determined the length of my leader ultimately.
Mm.
But the length of the furled leader always, probably in the main, was averaging between 3 foot and 36 inches and 48 inches.
Cool.
And as you said, I started to actually make those as a byproduct, a by income, and so I started to export them, and I exported them all over the world.
Wow.
All over the world,
yep.
And I'm not. We're not talking mass marketing here. You know, they were all the same price. If you wanted one 30 feet long, remember the longest one I ever made was 32 feet long.
Wow.
And the shortest was 6 inches, which was a nymphing indicator. Mm.
I have one of your nymph ones,
yeah,
the black one
with
the
orange. That's
plumbing.
It. Yep. So I made them really short, and they're all the same price, and I exported them all over the world for whatever post that was. You know, it was. You know, it makes it sound like an entrepreneur. It was nothing like that. It was just somebody ordered one and I posted it.
Yeah.
Sometimes that went to wherever, but it became almost like a ball and chain.
Yeah. I guess it's a lot of work, labour intensive.
Well, the problem was I was still guiding and teaching full time.
Come home, tie some leaders, go out, guide.
It became a problem.
Yeah.
So, you know, you'd be, you know, in the summer months, you'd be guiding out till relatively late because you potentially started late or started early, but you're out for a long time. I'd come home to orders.
Mm.
And the more they got known, the more orders I got.
Mm.
You know, so it wasn't just one a day. It became 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, and 10.
Mm.
And if I didn't do those tonight, I'd have to do 20 tomorrow and 30 the next day if I didn't do them then. So my day was just becoming ridiculous.
Yeah, yeah.
Getting to bed at like 2 in the morning.
That's no fun, is it?
And so it was an ultimatum.
Yeah.
There had to be an ultimatum. And that ultimatum was, one or the other had to go.
Yeah.
It was either the teaching, the guiding,
yeah,
and all the field leaders.
Yeah.
And so it was the field leaders. Cool. And so I stopped. Still made them. And I still made the occasional one now. I still demonstrate them. And I've been to many clubs and demonstrated them. But I stopped.
Yeah.
I stopped just for my sanity.
Cool.
Just for my sanity.
While I've got you, we're going to go on to... Well, I have got you. I don't want to just talk about the leaders because I think we should do some stuff with casting as well. But as a leaving point for the leaders... what is the one piece of advice generally you would give somebody about leaders if they want to self-roll them themselves or buy them? Is there anything that you should say, leader length, as you indicated, as long as you can get away with? Is there one piece of advice you would give somebody about leaders?
I
know you've got lots.
If I can just give you a couple. What I was instantly going to say was, yeah, always use a tapered leaders. But there's times when not to use a tapered leader. Certain nymphing situations. Yeah. I know a lot of competition anglers are into using just the same diameter throughout. And I totally get that about the quick sink of the leader. I totally get that. But from a knowledge of, if you start off by always using a tapered leader, if you're having an issue with presentation, start off with a tapered leader. A good rule of thumb is as a minimum length of your rod. So if you're using a 9 foot, I was actually saying a minimum of 9 feet, to be truthful, is probably a good benchmark, even if you're using a 7'6" rod. So use a tapered leader that is, I don't know, a butt section, which is, let's just say, 50%, 75% of the diameter of your fly line, whatever that may be. Probably getting a bit too technical that. But 9 feet long, tapered from thick to thin, a manufactured leader, one that a friend would recommend, that is what I would say start off with. From there, you can manipulate it in any way, shape or form. And I'm going to give a shout out, actually, and it may have been last month's Trout and Salmon or the previous one. I'll tell you who's done an amazing job at doing leaders. Paul Proctor.
Yeah.
Paul's done some great articles because, again, he's a similar advocate of that detail. If anybody knows, I'm sure everybody does, who Paul Proctor is as an angler. Information like that he and others have provided in magazines, those diagrams, cut them out or keep the magazine handy because they are gold dust. Those profiles are tried and tested. You know, if it's just that one leader, go for a tapered leader. And beyond that are all the nuances that you can alter.
Fantastic. Well, thanks for that very much indeed. I'm going to talk to you a little bit about casting. And having done a number of demonstrations with you, one of my favourite things that you say, and I nick it myself, I actually did it the other day with somebody, is that you ask the crowd if they play golf and they put their hand in the air. And then you say, do you go to the driving range and practice? And they all keep their arms in the air. And fly casting should be kind of similar. I'm from the same school as you, is that I practice not because I like throwing a nice loop on the grass and stuff like that. It makes me a better angler on the river. It enables me to cover fish better, etc., etc. How do you feel about that? You know, it's super key, isn't it, to practice. And then I find, you know, having taught people myself, is that when they're focused, when they're not worrying about that cast getting from A to B, they fish better.
Yeah. You can't do anything well if you don't know how to do it. And it's that practice. Nothing for me is, and nobody's a natural at anything. People are able to either logically understand it, to do things because they just have coordination. So people in some ways or others are just better to do stuff faster, quicker than anybody else. And that, you know, that we give them, oh, he's a natural at it. Well, you know, he's understood it and he's just better being able to coordinate himself to do it. But casting practice, if you want to be good at anything, you know, and you use that analogy, which I use a lot, which is the golfer. You know, I do not play golf. End of story. And there is no way that I should expect myself to walk out onto a golf course this afternoon and play around a golf well if I haven't put in the time to learn how to do it in the first place. And fly casting is absolutely no different. When you see a, and I think it's like anything in this, I think it's like anything, when you see somebody who is good at something, they make it look easy. And that's because they've put in the hard work and the groundwork to make it look easy. Like yourself, Pete, I know many fly casters that look poetic when they cast it, but I know they've put in that, you know, that 10,000 hour to get that good and to look that good. You know, that nobody just picks up a fly rod, Pete, and just casts accurately, further, faster, whatever you want to call it, in terms of loops and so on and so forth. So that practice is absolutely everything.
Yeah. You know, I love when I help you on the shows and stuff like that. You, me, Fernie, whoever it might be, just going out after the day after the show's finished and just cast, or get to the show early and cast for a bit and help each other and advise each other and stuff like that. And all those things help my fishing. There's no two ways about it. And I'll always come away from that saying, I need to work on that a little bit more. I should be working on that a little bit more. Is there something that you think an angler should look to develop, whether they're a river angler, whether they're a still water angler? What is it you think they should work on? Is it something like throwing off the other shoulder? Is it, what do you think they should work
on? To look. And if I can just explain that a wee bit more, which is, I remember back in the day, you know, when people were teaching, I've even done it myself, whereby you have them facing the target, and we get them into the process of a casting cycle, making a back cast and then a forward cast. And I still see it. I still see it now, where if you're not stood in such a way that allows you to turn your head to see what that back cast is doing, if you can't intuitively feel it because you know what to feel. I used to say all these things. Oh, how does that feel? Can you feel what that... No, I can't. Of course they can't. People don't know what they're supposed to feel, but you can at least know what you're supposed to see, or what we're seeing. You know, I remember when my father used to say to me, as I mentioned earlier, you know, your rod's going too far back behind you. Not once did I look behind to see that. You just kept on trying to adjust the arm so it wouldn't do that. Whereas if you stood into a, let's just say, you know, what we call the open stance, sort of square on, or side on, however people can sort of relate to that, whereby, you know, if you're accelerating into a back cast and you're able to turn your head and see it, what speed that line is traveling, in what direction it's traveling, you can then make whatever adjustment you need in the pitch and the angle of that rod to make sure that it does what you want it to do. If you get that right going back behind you, you've every chance of that forward being absolutely bang on, going ahead of you. Accuracy is a different thing altogether, but at least you know it's going forward. But if you've no idea what's going on behind you because you're not looking, it's guesswork. And this is why I think, from what I see from a lot of people, that when they make that forward cast, it's just brute force, because it's the only way that they understand that they can get that line out there, is just by chucking it as hard as they can in the hope that it lands and goes as far as they want it to go. So, I mean, that's probably a real basic caveman's view of that element of it.
But I think that's a really important one as well. And coming back to the chap, super nice guy I talked the other day, stillwater angler, throwing it up behind him. He's throwing it, as you say, a little bit too far back. We just threw it on the side and he could see everything. And then everything becomes a little bit clearer. He smoothed it out. As you say, being a stillwater angler, he wants to throw it a long way, so the acceleration comes in at the start, and invariably the wind knot or the tail comes into it. And we managed to get rid of that for him. And those things, I think, are really, really pertinent. And practice drills. You know, practicing, I remember a good friend of ours, Lee Cummings, at Casting Superstar, was saying about, you know, not doing 2 hours of casting. But I try and do 10, 15, 20 minutes of good casts and try and advise that. Is that
how you go, or do you do a little
bit? Yeah, well, it's one of these. I suppose it's all about recognizing fatigue, and you know, there's many a time, and I've made that mistake. I think, you know, if somebody said to me, "What's your biggest regret?" and it's not being able to meet the first person I ever taught, because I'd give them a week's free lessons and a week's free fishing, because I must have been just an utter nightmare.
Yeah,
I tried to download onto that guy everything I knew.
Yeah,
badly. But for, you know, through experience and over the years, you just get better, and you find a formula. You find a formula, and everybody's different. And although everybody's different, I teach in exactly the same way, which is the first thing you have to do is get them is know how they learn. Some people touchy-feely, some people want to hear it, some people just want to see it. And once you get that, once you understand how they learn, it's easy then to teach them. I'm not saying they get it. It's not easy to teach them to cast. What I'm saying is it's easy to then to know what path you then follow. Because if it's touchy-feely, if it's seeing, you know, you may do, they may want to see you do and therefore learn by what you do. But that's, I suppose, in some ways, that's the key for me, which is what they want to practice, what they need to learn, is only as good as what they've been told they need to understand and what they need to learn. So I know plenty of people that have got really good at doing the wrong thing. They're almost experts at it to a point, and there's many I can recollect where you have somebody that comes to you that wants to learn a particular cast. You put them right, they recognise that it right, but by default they go back to how they've always done it for the past 20 years. It's sort of, it's spots on a leopard type scenario.
Yeah,
spots on a leopard. But then that's your job as an instructor.
Yeah. Spotting those things, as you say, is the key thing. And listening, I think, is probably one of the most important things. And not going through that mantra of, right, this is that, and listening to what they need.
Well, and I've seen it, and I've done it. But so, you know, I'm not sat here thinking, you know, I'm the best at having not done it. And as I say, my successes have come from all my failures.
Yeah.
And if you're having to say to somebody, and again, I just go back, I keep going back to that comment my father used to say to me, your rod's going too far back, your rod's going too far back. And he must have said that 100 times. It didn't fix it. It should have been, right, if I'm going to say this for 101th time now. So he needs to say something different. So if you're repeating the same fault to somebody that you're just watching and trying to teach, there's an inordinate communication issue. You've got to come up with something different, because having said it 10 times, they're not going to put it right with you saying it 20. So you've got to have, there's a lot of stuff to being a smart instructor to know. You've got to be able to say the same thing 5 different ways.
I know it was interesting, the chap, again, coming back to that, I spoke to talked the other day. And like you say, knowing when to say something not. And you know what it's like when you first qualified, and when I worked for Nick down at X Valley, that you'd see people casting and it was really difficult not to say, and I didn't, well, look, like you say, your rod's going a little bit too, and we left it. And I've come to a stage now, it's really interesting, that I think, look, it's not my place to say something. And as long as they're out there enjoying it, what the hell?
Yeah.
It doesn't matter, does it?
Yeah. I suppose it all depends what they've come to you for.
No, I don't mean people who've come to me. I mean people, walking around a fishery you know, I've seen it where instructors walk up to people and say, look, if you do this and do an impromptu thing. Whereas if you... I think it's about enjoying it, isn't it? And it's supposed to be fun. We do this because it's fun, right?
Yeah, yeah. But I've seen a guy frustrate himself trying to enjoy it.
Yeah, exactly.
But I still won't say anything.
Yeah,
no, it's not.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah. You almost. Yeah, it's. Yeah, I know what you mean.
Yeah, it's fun. And coming there where we've touched on that, let's move around, because we've nearly done an hour now. Can you believe that?
Of
talking.
Pete, I talk rubbish. I can talk rubbish for hours.
What I want to talk about though is Canada and how much you love that, and you know, I know in the last issue of Fly Culture, we have one of your beautiful pictures. I think it was the opening shot for the magazine, actually, if I remember rightly.
Thank you.
Of your friend fishing one of the streams in Canada. And I know that you go there in the winter and you dog sled, which
I think that's probably a podcast in itself, a dog mushing podcast, not fishing one. But you go out there and have made and forged friendships there.
Yeah.
And now you go back there and go fish there and go right out into the wilderness there. And I know that you've written for East Sleep Fish about those trips as well, and the bear bells that you're wearing because you're right out in the wilderness camping out there. What does that mean to you and those cutthroat that you're fishing there and the wilderness and the rivers comparable to what you're doing back here?
I could probably, what it means to me, and I can probably sum that up very quickly. If I was never to fish the whole year in the UK and only fish there, I'm happy. I'm happy.
Hmm.
Well, you've just literally plagiarised every word I was going to say.
Sorry,
which was the wilderness, the experience, the rivers, the fish, are just off the scale.
Hmm.
And I'm not talking huge fish by any stretch of the imagination. You know, I've caught bigger fish, bigger brown trout over here in some of the rivers. But it's just collectively in an environment where you're on, without overusing the word, in the middle of nowhere. One of my favourite rivers happens to be the Oldman in Alberta. You really are in the middle of nowhere, festooned with whatever wildlife would have no qualms about eating you for breakfast. Given an opportunity.
Mm.
But we do it in a very, very safe way. And I do it with a very responsible friend. I just make sure I can run faster than him. So
yeah.
I've no issues.
That's where the marathons come from.
That's it, yeah. I'm learning to run even faster than
yeah.
him. But it's just that environment. And a lot of everything that I do over here, river fishing, translates over there.
Mm.
I don't have special kit for Canada. Mm. I'm fortunate to have a very good friend, and you know him well, Warren McCarthy, who ties fantastic flies.
Yeah.
Now that I don't, and my eyesight's gone to pot. So I suppose the only thing that changes with what I take over there invariably is fly choice.
Hmm.
Everything else remains the same.
Yeah.
Everything else remains the same. But that environment, I could get lost in that.
Yeah.
Oh, my word.
Yeah.
If I could survive Bear Grylls style, which I know I can't.
Yeah.
Take me there tomorrow.
Yeah.
Just, but that for me is absolute heaven.
Yeah.
It's only having been there, and I was lucky to having to have gone there, and that it all stems from having friends having been made from the dog sledding that I do, that allows me to go back, and because I can, I shouldn't compare it with anything over here because it doesn't compare. Mm.
And that brings us nicely to your work with Vision in the UK. And, you know, their Vision are a Finnish company and super cool stuff that they do. There seems to be more like the US than here in fishing, you know, and I go and fish out in Denmark a fair bit. Younger anglers out there doing their thing. The products that they're bringing out are funkier, dare I say it, cooler, really, really interesting stuff. And do you see that when you go over to Finland as well and what those guys are developing for that marketplace and beyond? Or?
Yeah, I used to use Vision while I was teaching and guarding. So I was familiar with the products to a certain degree before I became the brand manager. Working under guide fly fishing, and I remember the first time going over to Vision, just outside of Helsinki, and walking around the offices. There are a bunch of young, cool guides. You know, if anybody's seen Canal Gratis and got to see videos of Antti Guttorm and Nicholas Bauer, who assists with Vision, and Thomas Ritkinen. These guys, these are young guys. You know, these are keen as mustard. They have the same attitude that I had over here when I was into fly fishing, just on a bigger scale.
Mm.
And I remember going to meet them first of all, and the enthusiasm, the knowledge was frightening. When you're immersed in that as your everyday life. You immerse yourself completely, as we did,
mm.
you know, for whatever yep. we do. And I swore blind. I expected to go around those offices and see a square reel and see a square fly fishing reel because there was some weird and wonderful stuff. Some weird colours. The guys are not frightened of coming forward when it comes to colours, as most people will know. And they're innovative in many ways. Some of the designs of product that I've seen and some of the test models of products that I've seen are just way out there, way out there. And the market's not even ready for it. And I'm sure you could go to similar manufacturers to see the same, because these, it's almost, you're asking these, it's almost like putting, I don't know, scientists into a room full of bits, chemicals and all kinds of stuff and say, just make stuff. Do stuff.
Yeah, that's cool.
And that's what these guys do. They'll just do stuff.
Yeah.
And it's exciting.
Yeah.
It really is.
And I suppose it's handy that Pike is a big part of their marketplace. It's been we've been piking for a long time, I know, but that's certainly a growth area in the UK as well. Huge. So that must be
If you look at all the big reservoirs now, so you know, and there's still a few that don't, but you know, Chew Valley. I hear more about Chew Valley about Pike than I do
absolutely
trout, and that back in the day that was just that was just not the case. You know, you have Ibrook, you have Rutland, all these big reservoirs are catching some immense pike that just weren't fished for. And so were just left to get on to become the dinosaurs, and the size of these things that they're catching nowadays, because they're being targeted targeted by really good pike anglers. And it is, it's a strong part of the business for Vision. You know, we're lucky to have the likes of people like Nicholas Bauer, Daniel Bergman, and guys that are professional at this stuff, that are at the top of their game for this particular type of predator fishing, and they help us in the way in the design of product, and you know, we have, you know, such a range of this predator type product as well as others that just do well over here, as many others do, you know, as many others do, because it is a very, very strong part of the fly fishing industry.
And I guess what we're going to see with these hot summers and everything else, diversification, in that fly anglers, the rivers have got, you know, at home, my river, the Tour's got no water in it at the moment. I'm just praying for rain right now.
Yeah, you've driven over a river here with nothing in it.
Yeah, there's nothing, yeah. And you know, people are going to look at other stuff. Mullet again is hugely, you know, it's always been around the fringes, but people are starting to look at those, the bass, those sorts of bits and pieces. So I guess that's going to be an interesting diversification that we're going to continue to see in fishing looking ahead.
I wish people would diversify more. I know, and I'm sure you do, and the further north you go, certainly into Scotland, and I've been chatting with people that know this better than I. You have salmon anglers that just will not fish for anything else other than salmon. Trout anglers that won't fish for anything other than trout. And I think you're no better place than you are today to be able to diversify in what's available to the angler, whereby, you know, if you go out as a salmon angler, this is probably a better example than any. You go out as a salmon angler, and the water's just wrong.
Yeah.
You know, not everybody lives on a river. They can pop down and go back home within a quarter now. Some people buy days or buy weeks where they have to be there because they've bought that time. You know, and as disappointing as the fishing may be, because, you know, you can't control the conditions, nor the weather, nor the fish. That, you know, a salmon river could, what is ultimately a poor salmon river at that time, could be a great trout one. And so whatever opportunity I ever get to go into Scotland to fish for salmon, it'll always be supported by a trout rod.
Yeah, nice.
Absolutely by a trout rod.
Yeah.
And in the same way that if you're going trout fishing and, you know, you're going onto a reservoir and it's not happening for trout, why wouldn't you want a pike rod?
Yeah.
Assuming that that's that again. So
yeah,
you're just in a great position to fish for anything.
Yeah.
And I wish I wish that anglers would do more of that.
Yeah.
Which
I think we're going to see that, aren't we?
I'd like to think so. I'd like to hope so.
Okay, two last quick questions. Hall of Fame rod, what is it? I think I know the answer to this one.
That is a mag 10 foot, yep. 3-4 weight. And I only say that because I had that before I even started revision. Mm. And it was just...
I know you that, used to rave about it. Yeah.
That, to me, has just been one of the best rods I've ever cast.
Yep.
For a number of reasons that we've not got the time to go into in detail, but that mag 10 foot was just... That's the rod I took to Canada all the time. I'd cast it in any conditions, and I'd nail fish in any situation.
Fantastic. Cool. And your last one, fishing hero.
My dad.
Brilliant.
Full stop.
Yep. Fantastic. I guess that theme has come through on this as well. Mm. So that's wonderful to hear. Jim, thank you.
It's been waffle.
No, it's been great waffle, and I've really, really enjoyed listening. Thank you so much for letting me come along here and talk to you about this sort of stuff. It's been, and I hope our listeners as well find that interesting, and it inspires them to look at tying up some leaders, to think at things slightly differently, perhaps think about, you know, casting a little bit more in a different, slightly different way. And it's been an absolute pleasure, as always, catching up with you and talking with you. That's the end of this Fly Culture podcast. We've got some more planned for you. We really hope you've enjoyed that. If you have, you'll consider perhaps leaving a review on iTunes or even subscribing to us. Of course, this is a standalone to the Fly Culture magazine that we publish quarterly. We hope you've enjoyed this, and we try and take the content with these a little bit differently. If you do consider buying Fly Culture magazine, you can buy that from flyculturemag.com. We're on Instagram, we're on Facebook, we try and keep those updated for you, and we hope you dig what we're trying to do. This is Pete Tigers signing off. I'm wishing you good fishing. We're hoping for some rain, and we look forward to doing another podcast for you real soon. Thanks for listening.